A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You've heard the name Netanyahu 1,000 times, but there's a name that's been surfacing in Israeli politics lately that might actually change the calculus. Daniel wants to know who Gadi Eisenkot is, what he's done to threaten Netanyahu's grip on power, and why the timing right now makes this more than just another challenger throwing his hat in. He's asking whether a former general can succeed where so many others have failed.
And the short answer is, maybe. But not for the reasons most people assume. Eisenkot isn't running on charisma or a sweeping ideological vision. He's running on a resume that says, I kept this country safe, and the guy in charge now didn't.
Let's start with the man himself, because his resume isn't your typical politician's.
Gadi Eisenkot was the IDF chief of staff from 2015 to 2019. Before that, he was deputy chief, head of Northern Command, commander of the Gaza Division. He spent basically his entire adult life in uniform. And he oversaw the military during what was, by Israeli standards, a relatively quiet period on the Gaza front. Not peaceful, but contained. It is, but that's the point. Eisenkot's signature doctrine was something called the Campaign Between Wars, in Hebrew, Mabum. The idea was to carry out sustained, targeted strikes against Iranian and Hezbollah assets in Syria without letting things escalate into a full-scale war. Hundreds of strikes over several years, most of them never publicly acknowledged, all designed to degrade enemy capabilities while keeping the northern border quiet enough that people could live their lives.
So he's the architect of a strategy that says you can fight a war without anyone noticing you're fighting a war. That's either brilliant or deeply unsettling.
It's both, and that tension is exactly what makes him politically interesting. The security hawks love him because he was willing to strike Iranian positions repeatedly. The pragmatists respect him because he understood escalation thresholds and didn't drag the country into a broader conflict. He managed to be aggressive and restrained at the same time.
Which is a hard needle to thread. Most military figures get branded as one or the other.
Right. And that's the foundation of his political capital. But here's where it gets concrete. In late August 2026, so literally days ago, Eisenkot launched a new political party. The Times of Israel and Haaretz both covered it as a direct threat to Netanyahu's rule. He didn't join an existing party. He didn't form a tactical alliance. He stood up and said, essentially, I'm building something new because the current leadership has failed.
What's he actually saying about Netanyahu?
He's been escalating for a while. Back in 2024, he gave an interview where he said Netanyahu's government had lost its moral compass on security matters. That's not a policy disagreement, that's a character indictment from a former chief of staff. And during the 2023 judicial overhaul, he was one of the most prominent former military figures warning that the legislation was fracturing IDF morale and national cohesion. He argued that when reservists start refusing to serve, you've crossed a red line that has real security consequences.
So his break with Netanyahu isn't new. He's been building toward this.
For at least 3 years. But what's new is the party and the platform. He's positioning himself as a unity candidate, someone who can bridge left and right, specifically on security grounds. The Jerusalem Post noted that his party is drawing from disillusioned Likud voters and centrists, people who are tired of Netanyahu's polarizing style but can't bring themselves to vote for the left.
That's the key mechanism, isn't it? He's not offering a left-wing platform. He's offering a technocratic, defense-focused alternative.
And that's what makes him dangerous to Netanyahu in a way that, say, Yair Lapid or Benny Gantz weren't. Lapid is a centrist, but he's not a security figure. Gantz is also a former chief of staff. He served before Eisenkot, but his 2019 run ultimately got absorbed into the system. He ended up joining a unity government with Netanyahu, then left, and his credibility took a hit. Eisenkot is running explicitly to end Netanyahu's rule, not to share power with him.
Let me press on that. Gantz was also a former chief of staff. He also ran on security credentials. He also polled well initially. What's different this time?
A few things. First, The political context is much worse for Netanyahu now than it was in 2019. His coalition currently holds 61 seats. That's the bare minimum. Eisenkot's party is polling at 8 to 10 seats, which doesn't sound like much. But in a 61-seat coalition, peeling off even a handful changes the math entirely. If Eisenkot takes 5% of Likud voters, Netanyahu can't form a government without him.
So, he doesn't need to win. He needs to be the kingmaker.
That's the Haaretz analysis from August 30th. They argue Eisenkot is positioning himself as exactly that, the person who decides whether the next government is formed by Netanyahu or by someone else. And he's building infrastructure now because the expectation is that elections could come as early as 2027, possibly sooner if the coalition fractures.
Walk me through the fractures. What's actually fraying?
Three things, all stacking. The judicial overhaul protests in 2023 split the country in ways that still haven't healed. You had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets for months, reservists threatening to refuse service, the economy jittery. Then there's the ongoing corruption trials. Netanyahu is still in court, and that's been hanging over every decision his government makes. And then there's the security situation.
Which is where Eisenkot's credentials bite hardest.
Right. Because if you're a Likud voter who's been loyal to Netanyahu for 15 years, the one thing that might make you reconsider is the feeling that security has deteriorated on his watch. Eisenkot can stand up and say, "I ran the military during a period of relative stability. I know how to manage these threats. The current leadership has lost control." That's a message that lands differently coming from him than from a career politician.
So what's his actual platform beyond Netanyahu has to go?
Three pillars. First, prioritize national security, but with a specific emphasis on reducing political interference in military decision-making. He's argued that Netanyahu has politicized the IDF's chain of command, and that's dangerous. Second, restore public trust in institutions, the courts, the civil service, the police. And third, what he calls national unity, which in Israeli terms means finding a governing consensus that doesn't treat half the country as the enemy.
That third one is doing a lot of rhetorical work. Unity can mean anything from a grand coalition to just, "I'm not as divisive as the other guy."
It can. But in Eisenkot's case, it seems to mean something more specific. He's not calling for a binational state or a Palestinian peace process. He's a security hawk. He believes in military strength. But he also believes that internal cohesion is a national security asset, that a country fighting itself can't fight its enemies effectively. That's the thread running through his criticism of the judicial overhaul, his warnings about reservist refusals, and now his party launch.
So the argument is, I'll keep you safe from external threats, and I won't tear the country apart doing it.
That's the pitch. And it's designed to appeal to people who are exhausted. Exhausted by the protests, exhausted by the corruption headlines, exhausted by the sense that everything is one crisis away from collapse.
Let's talk about the comparison to other military figures who became prime minister. You mentioned Rabin, Sharon, Barak.
Ehud Barak was chief of staff, became prime minister in 1999. Ariel Sharon was a general, became prime minister in 2001. Yitzhak Rabin was chief of staff, became prime minister in the 70s and again in the 90s. Israel has a long tradition of generals transitioning to political leadership, but each of those figures had a longer political runway. Barak joined Labor and worked his way up. Sharon helped found the Likud. Rabin spent years as an ambassador and cabinet minister.
Eisenkot is skipping all of that.
He's launching a party from scratch, with the explicit goal of unseating a sitting prime minister. That's not how it's usually done. Normally, you join an existing party, build a faction, run in a primary. Eisenkot is essentially saying the existing parties are too compromised or too polarized to be vehicles for change. He's betting that his personal credibility can substitute for party infrastructure.
Which is a huge gamble. Personal credibility fades fast in a parliamentary system. You can't just give orders.
And that might be his biggest vulnerability. He's never had to compromise. He's never had to negotiate a coalition agreement or trade committee assignments for votes. In the IDF, when you're chief of staff, you give an order and it's carried out. The Knesset doesn't work that way.
So, the thing that makes him credible, his military career, is also the thing that might make him ineffective as a politician.
That's the tension. And it's the same tension that's tripped up other general-turned-politicians. Barak was brilliant but couldn't hold a coalition together. Sharon evolved into a statesman but only after decades in politics. Rabin was assassinated before we could see the full arc.
Let me pull on a thread here. You said Eisenkot's party is polling at 8 to 10 seats. Where are those voters coming from?
The Jerusalem Post analysis suggests it's a mix. Some are disillusioned, Likud voters, people who still consider themselves right-wing but can't stomach Netanyahu personally anymore. Some are centrists who voted for Gantz in 2019 and 2020 and felt burned when he joined the unity government. And some are from the softer right, people who might have voted for Naftali Bennett or Avigdor Lieberman in previous cycles.
So he's pulling from the right and the center simultaneously. That's unusual.
It is. And it's possible precisely because he's not running on a traditional left-right axis. He's running on competence, on security, on institutional integrity. Those aren't ideological positions, they're governance positions. A Likud voter who disagrees with Eisenkot on settlements can still look at him and say, but he'll keep the northern border quiet.
And the left? Where do they fit?
That's the awkward part. The left in Israel is diminished. The Labor Party that Rabin led is a shadow of itself. Meretz didn't even cross the threshold in the last election. So Eisenkot isn't really courting the left, he's courting the center and the soft right. The left might hold their nose and vote for him as the only viable path to removing Netanyahu, but he's not their candidate.
So the coalition he's trying to build is security-conscious right-wingers who are tired of Netanyahu, plus centrists who want functional government, plus whatever remains of the left that's willing to be pragmatic.
And that's a fragile coalition, because the moment you start talking about actual policy, settlements, the Palestinian issue, relations with the U.S., those groups don't agree on much. Eisenkot's bet is that remove Netanyahu is a strong enough glue to hold them together through an election, and that once he's in power, security credibility gives him the latitude to make compromises.
That's a bet that worked exactly once in recent memory. The Anyone But Bibi coalition that Bennett and Lapid formed in 2021. And that fell apart within a year and a half.
It did. And Eisenkot knows that. Which is why his rhetoric isn't just Netanyahu must go. It's also the system needs to be rebuilt. He's trying to offer something more durable than a negative coalition. Whether he can deliver, it's a different question.
Let's talk about the timing. Why now? Why August 2026?
Several factors converging. First, the coalition is fragile. 61 seats means any single MK can bring it down. Second, the corruption trial continues to generate headlines and erode public trust. Third, there's a sense that the security situation has deteriorated. I won't dwell on specific events, but the post-October 2023 landscape has changed how Israelis think about security. And fourth, elections are likely coming in 2027 regardless. Eisenkot is building infrastructure now, so he's ready when the campaign actually starts.
So he's not forcing an election. He's positioning for the one that's already coming.
And that's strategically smart. If he tried to bring down the government now, he'd be blamed for triggering an unnecessary election. If he waits, he can say he gave the coalition every chance to govern, and now it's time for a change.
There's something else I want to flag. Eisenkot's criticism of Netanyahu isn't just about policy, it's about morality. Lost its moral compass? Isn't language you use about a budget dispute?
No, it's not. And that matters because it speaks to something deeper than electoral math. Eisenkot is part of a generation of military leaders who see themselves as guardians of something larger than policy. They see themselves as guardians of the state's character. When he talks about the judicial overhaul damaging IDF morale, he's not making a technical argument about readiness. He's saying that the social contract between the military and the society it protects has been violated.
That's a heavy claim.
It is. And it's one that resonates with a lot of Israelis who served, or whose children served, or who see the IDF as the one institution that still functions. If you convince people that the military's integrity is at stake, you've moved the conversation from politics to something closer to patriotism.
Which is why Netanyahu's camp has been so aggressive in pushing back. They can't let Eisenkot own the security argument.
They can't. And they've been trying to paint him as just another left-wing challenger in uniform, but that's a hard sell when the guy spent his career bombing Iranian positions in Syria. The leftist label doesn't stick to someone with his operational record.
So, what's their actual line of attack?
Two things. One, They argue he's naive about coalition politics, that he'll end up dependent on the left and the Arab parties to form a government which would make him unable to actually govern. Two, they point to his post-army record. He's been out of uniform since 2019, and they argue he's been politicized by his time in think tanks and on the speaking circuit.
The first attack is probably more effective than the second. He'll need the Arabs to govern is a well-worn line in Israeli politics.
It is. And it works on a certain segment of the electorate. But Eisenkot's counter is interesting. He said he won't rule out any coalition partner that accepts Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. That leaves the door open to Arab parties while maintaining a red line. It's a careful formulation.
Let's zoom out for a moment. What does Eisenkot's rise tell us about Israeli politics more broadly?
I think it tells us that the Netanyahu era is entering a new phase. Not necessarily its end, we've predicted that wrong too many times, but a phase where the opposition is no longer just opposing, they're building alternatives. Eisenkot represents a specific kind of alternative, the security establishment saying, essentially, we can do better than the politicians.
That's a pattern that shows up in other democracies too. The general who runs on competence, Eisenhower, de Gaulle.
And it tends to happen at moments when civilian institutions are perceived as failing. When people lose faith in the normal political process, they look for someone who seems to operate outside it. Eisenkot's whole pitch is, I'm not a politician. That's either refreshing or alarming, depending on your view of democratic norms.
Refreshing if you think the politicians have broken the system. Alarming if you think the answer to broken politics is fewer politicians.
Right. And Israel has always had a blurry line between military and political leadership. It's built into the country's DNA because security has always been existential. But there's a difference between a general who retires, joins a party, and works his way up, and a general who retires and says, the whole system is broken and I'm starting fresh. The second is a bigger bet and a bigger risk.
What's the most common misconception people have about Eisenkot?
That he's a left-wing candidate. He's not. He's a security hawk, running on a unity platform. His criticism of Netanyahu isn't that Netanyahu is too conservative. It's that Netanyahu has failed at the thing conservatives care about most, security and institutional integrity. If you're expecting Eisenkot to pursue a peace process or make territorial concessions, you're probably going to be disappointed. That's not who he is.
So he's not the Israeli Obama. He's more like the Israeli Colin Powell, who decided to run.
That's not a bad analogy. A respected military figure, broadly centrist, seen as above the partisan fray, running on character and competence rather than ideology. And like Powell, the question is whether that's enough in a system that runs on ideology and coalition math.
Let me ask you something. You practiced medicine in Jerusalem for years. You know this society from the inside. Does Eisenkot's pitch land? Or is this a media narrative that doesn't connect with actual voters?
I think it lands with a specific segment. Secular, security-conscious, middle-class Israelis who are exhausted by the current government but don't see a home in the existing opposition. Those voters exist in significant numbers. Whether there are enough of them to translate 8 to 10 seats into something more, that's the open question. The Israeli electorate is more fragmented than it's ever been. Small parties can be kingmakers, but they rarely become the largest party.
And the religious parties. Eisenkot presumably doesn't have much appeal there.
Almost none. The Haredi parties have their own interests. Yeshiva funding, draft exemptions, and they've been reliable Netanyahu coalition partners because he delivers on those. Eisenkot isn't going to outbid Netanyahu for Haredi support, and he probably doesn't want to. His path runs through the center, not the religious right.
Which means, even if he wins big, he's looking at a complicated coalition negotiation.
Every Israeli coalition negotiation is complicated. The question is whether Eisenkot's personal credibility gives him leverage that other center-left leaders lacked. Gantz couldn't hold his coalition together. Lapid managed it briefly, but couldn't sustain it. Eisenkot is betting that his security credentials give him a longer leash with right-wing coalition partners, that they'll trust him on defense even if they disagree on other things.
And if that bet fails?
Then he becomes another Gantz. A former chief of staff who looked promising, polled well, and got absorbed into the system without fundamentally changing it. That's the trap. And Eisenkot knows it's the trap. The question is whether launching his own party, rather than joining an existing one, is enough to avoid it.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, about the campaign between wars. That doctrine is fascinating because it's essentially a theory of how to manage permanent conflict without letting it consume everything. And Eisenkot is now applying a version of that thinking to politics.
Say more.
Well, the Mabum concept is about calibrated action. Strike enough to degrade the threat, not so much that you trigger escalation. You're managing a simmer rather than trying to put out the fire. Eisenkot's political strategy feels similar. He's not trying to destroy Netanyahu in one blow. He's positioning himself as the inevitable alternative, building infrastructure, waiting for the moment when the coalition fractures on its own. He's campaigning between elections.
That's actually a really sharp way to think about it. The campaign between elections, low intensity, sustained, designed to degrade the opponent's position without triggering a premature confrontation.
And the risk is the same as the military version. You can manage a simmer for years, but eventually something ignites it. A miscalculation, an external shock, a moment when the other side decides to escalate. Eisenkot's strategy works if the political environment remains roughly stable. If there's a sudden crisis, a security event, an economic shock, the whole calculus changes.
And Netanyahu is very good at exploiting crises. He survived this long in part because he knows how to use emergencies to reshape the political landscape. If something big happens between now and the next election, Eisenkot's careful positioning could become irrelevant overnight.
The clock is ticking in both directions. Eisenkot needs enough time to build his party infrastructure, but not so much time that a crisis lets Netanyahu reset the board.
That's the tension, and it's why the August 2026 launch timing matters. He's giving himself roughly a year to build before the expected election cycle. Enough time to be credible, not so much time that the window closes.
Hilbert, you've been quiet.
Wait, you actually met him?
2018. I was doing a consulting gig for a defense contractor in Tel Aviv. Don't ask which one. I signed something. And Eisenkot came to brief a small group of us on the northern border threat. Maybe 15 people in a conference room. He spent 20 minutes drawing diagrams on a napkin. Iranian positions, Hezbollah supply routes, Syrian air defense coverage, all on a napkin.
What kind of napkin?
Cloth. From the hotel restaurant. He'd been at lunch.
What did you make of him?
Completely different register than any politician I've ever been in a room with. No performance, no working the crowd. He talked like an engineer describing a structural problem. Here's the load, here's the stress point, here's where it fails. Someone asked about the political dimension, and he just sidestepped it. Said that was above his pay grade.
But it wasn't above his pay grade. He was the chief of staff. The political dimension is part of the job.
He knew that. You could tell he knew that. He just didn't want to perform it. And that's the thing people miss about him. He's not a politician who happens to have worn a uniform. He's a soldier who got tired of watching politicians screw up security. But that's also his weakness.
How so?
He's never had to compromise on anything. In the IDF, when you're at that level, you build a plan and people execute it. In the Knesset, you can't just order people to fall in line. You have to trade. You have to swallow things you hate. I watched him for 20 minutes and I thought, this man has never had to vote for a budget that included something he thought was dangerous because someone else needed it for their district.
That's the vulnerability you were describing earlier. The flip side of the credential.
Do you still have the napkin?
Framed. In my basement. Next to a signed photo of a very different Israeli general.
I'm not going to ask.
The thing I keep coming back to is whether Eisenkot's lack of political experience is actually a liability, or whether it's the whole product. Voters are so tired of career politicians that never done this before might be a feature, not a bug.
It's a feature until the first coalition negotiation. Then, it's a liability.
That's the bet, isn't it? That his personal credibility buys him enough runway to learn on the job.
I've seen that bet made before. Sometimes it works. Usually it doesn't.
The counterexample in Israeli politics is actually Sharon. He was a general who became a politician, and he was terrible at the political game for years. Lost elections, got sidelined, was considered a loose cannon. Then he figured it out and became prime minister. The question is whether Eisenkot gets a Sharon-length learning curve, or whether the current environment is too impatient for that.
The current environment isn't patient. The news cycle is measured in hours. If Eisenkot stumbles in his first 6 months as a party leader, the polls will reflect it within days.
The napkin was good, though. Detailed. He knew every kilometer of those supply routes.
You're going to mention that napkin every time his name comes up, aren't you?
It's a good napkin.
Here's the misconception I want to address before we wrap. People look at Eisenkot and think, another general who thinks he can be prime minister. We've seen this movie. But that misses what's actually new here. He's not running to be the next Rabin or Barak. He's running to break the Netanyahu binary. The question isn't whether he wins. It's whether he reshapes the field enough that someone else can.
He's not necessarily the end of Netanyahu. He might be the beginning of the end. The figure who cracks the coalition math, even if he doesn't end up at the top of the next government. That's a different kind of legacy.
It depends on something we can't know yet. Whether the fractures in Israeli society are deep enough that a unity candidate can actually unite, or whether the divisions are now structural and permanent. Eisenkot is betting they're not. We'll find out if he's right.
The 2027 election cycle will be the test. If Eisenkot's party holds those 8 to 10 seats or grows, then the Netanyahu era has entered a new phase. If it collapses like so many centrist parties before it, then the old dynamics reassert themselves and we're back to where we started.
One way or another, we're watching a realignment attempt in real time.
Those don't come around often.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the napkin story we're all going to be hearing about for years.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to reach us, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.